Good morning. I'll be reading from Revelation 10. Then I saw another mighty angel coming down from heaven. He was robed in a cloud with a rainbow above his head. His face was like the sun, and his legs were like fiery pillars. He was holding a little scroll, which lay open in his hand. He planted his right foot on the sea and his left foot on the land. And he gave a loud shout like a roar of a lion. When he shouted, the voices of the seven thunders spoke. And when the seven thunders spoke, I was about to write. But I heard a voice from heaven say, "Seal up what the seven thunders have said, and do not write it down." Then the angel I had seen standing on the sea and on the land raised his right hand to heaven. And he swore by him who lives forever and ever, who created the heavens and all that is in them, the earth and all that is in it, and the sea and all that is in it, and said, "There will be no more delay. But in the days when the seventh angel is about to sound his trumpet, the mystery of God will be accomplished, just as he announced to his servants, the prophets." Then the voice that I had heard from heaven spoke to me once more, "Go, take the scroll that lies open in the hand of the angel who is standing on the sea and on the land." So I went to the angel and asked him to give me the little scroll. He said to me, "Take it and eat it, and it will turn your stomach sour, but in your mouth it will be sweet as honey." I took the little scroll from the angel's hand and ate it. It tasted sweet as honey in my mouth, but when I had eaten it, my stomach turned sour. Then I was told, "You must prophesy again about many peoples, nations, languages, and kings."
And if you'd like to follow along, you can turn in your Bibles this morning to Revelation 10. I think the last time I preached, if I remember correctly, we were having lunch afterwards, and it was fairly short, and some of the ladies were mad at me because they weren't quite ready with the food by the time I had finished. So if I go short this morning, is anyone going to be upset? No? Okay. All right. Just wanted to make sure, because I can ramble on if you need me to. But amen? No? That was my dad. Yeah. Well, like father, like son. So, Laura was talking about mystery, and sometimes when we think about the book of Revelation, it's mystified. It seems like the entire book is something of a mystery. And I've been teaching through Revelation in my Sunday school class as well, and I've told them that you are welcome to disagree with me, to have a contrary thought, to have a different idea, and I'm okay with that. What I like to do, though, is I like to try to demystify it, and when I say that, I mean that I don't want to get bogged down in the weeds of the details, because we could spend our time in the weeds of the details and miss the larger point that's being made. So I really want to stick to what I think is the larger point. And as I've read through Revelation, I've taught through Revelation before, and as I've done so again or started to do so again, and now thinking about preaching here from chapter 10, one of the things that I have noticed as I've read through is that it seems to be that on a regular basis, one of the things that is happening in these visions and dreams that John is both receiving and sharing with us is that there seems to be some kind of tie-in to something that would have been very familiar to him from the past. And mostly from some story of the Bible, some event in the life of Israel, something that they went through that is being drawn on from the past. And if that's the case, and I believe that it is, then I don't think that the meaning that we're intended to get from these visions is going to be wildly different from the meaning of the thing that would have come to John's mind when he read it. Let me just cut to the chase real quick on this. In the first part of chapter 10, we see some images that ought to bring to mind to us something from the Old Testament. We see this angel, and it says that the angel was coming down from heaven wrapped in a cloud with a rainbow over his head, and then just a few verses later, we hear about thunder. Now, from the Old Testament, is there any image that comes to your mind where you would associate clouds and a rainbow and thunder? Probably Noah. Yeah, Noah. And so as John sees this vision, I think he would have thought, well, this looks very much like, there are some symbols, there are some images here that very much remind me of the story of Noah. And I don't think that's an accident. I think that he's being called to remember what was that story of Noah all about, because the story of Noah may help us to understand what this vision is all about. And so that covers the first piece. And then the last piece, which has to do with the scroll, I think would have also brought something to mind for John. Now, this isn't going to be as obvious for us because it's probably a less known passage in the Bible, but it actually pulls a little bit from chapter 9 last week, which had that vision of scorpions. And if we were to go to Ezekiel chapter 2, we would see that Ezekiel is given a prophecy, and he talks about Israel as, he uses the image of scorpions, but he also talks about how God told him to eat a scroll and that it would taste like honey in his mouth, which we find again here. So I'm going to draw from those two things in the Old Testament that I think would have immediately come to John's mind about what this vision means here. Now, how's the world feel to you? Everything all right? Going well? Everything as planned, right? I mean, you know what you want your life to look like, you know what you want it to be like, and it is going just exactly as you envisioned it in your mind, right? You've got everything that you ever dreamed that you'd want. You've done everything that you dreamed that you would do. You never receive any news that catches you off guard, much less disappoints you. It's just all like you had planned it. And this world, if you sit back and consider what the world is like, it's just exactly like you thought it would be, right? I got to reflecting this past week on the jobs that I've had. I don't know why I was doing that, but I was reflecting on the various jobs that I've had. And so for almost 20 years, I was a pastor. And one thing that I want to say is thank you, Snow Hill Baptist Church, for being the kind of church that would even tolerate a pastor for 30 years. Because I've pastored churches that could hardly tolerate one for 4 years. And as much as you think that, you know, a pastor just works one day a week and then enjoys golf and for your pastor, disc golf and fishing and watching Oprah in the afternoon and all that, as much as you envision that as the life of a pastor, there are good times for sure, but there are also times that are very tough. There was, when we were in Atoka, there was a little boy, grandson of one of the couples in our church, who was on a tractor ride with Grandpa, and he fell off of that tractor, hit his head on a rock, and bled out and died. And I got to do that funeral. Very difficult. When we were in Sepulpa, there was a teenage girl who was the daughter of one of our deacons, a police officer in the community, and she was out just riding around with some friends on a weekend night, and the girl that was driving the truck lost control. They went off of the road, slammed into a tree, and this young girl died, and I got to do their funeral. And that's just a fraction of what I know Todd has gotten to do, had to do, however you want to describe it, in 30 years here at Snow Hill. There have been tragedies that have happened in the life of the community and the life of the church, and those things can be very difficult. And in some churches, on top of that, you get contrarians who don't make life real fun all the time. But so I thought, okay, well, I've been a pastor, and that came with some difficulties. And the job that I had before we moved back up here in Texas was I was in mortgage servicing. I was helping people who, you know, the housing market crashed in what was about 2009. And so in 2011, I started working in mortgage servicing, trying to work with people who couldn't pay their home loan anymore. And can you imagine the distress of thinking that you're going to lose your house because you lost your job and you just couldn't make your house payment anymore? So my job was to try to help people out of that situation. But you can imagine that if you were at risk of losing your home, the kind of stress that that would put on you. And so I got to be the recipient of a lot of that stress. And it wasn't my fault, but I was the company in the eyes of a lot of people. And so it became my fault on some occasions. And now I'm in sales, which I tell people, businesses that I work with, I tell them all the time, don't be afraid to tell me no, because I'm in sales. And I get told no a whole lot more than I get told yes. So it just feels like every job I've had I remember one time in mortgage servicing, I was literally at my desk because this attorney was chewing me out, and I was literally like this, talking to him, just banging my forehead on the desk. And it's like, why didn't I choose? I mean, I could have been a carnival barker. I could have done a lot of things. Circus clown, a lot of things that would have made people happy. And for some reason, it seems like I've always had a job where there's been something negative, some real negative vibe about it. Even though there's a lot of joy in it as well. But, you know, if the world were perfect, we would all love what we did all the time, right? But it's not. The world is broken, and a part of that brokenness involves 4-year-olds falling off the tractor and dying. But it's not just the stuff that happens to us or the crazy accidents that are a part of our world, but it just seems like a lot of it is stuff that we manufacture ourselves. We create our own problems, not only for ourselves, but for our world. We too often participate in the brokenness of the world. And it may just be in a conversation that we're having with a spouse or a child or a friend that turns into an argument, and it might just be something that we ought to drop and leave it alone, but we just keep on, and we do it to the extent that we hurt someone's feelings, and now a relationship is damaged, and I participated in that. I helped bring it about. And so sometimes we participate in the conditions of the world such as it is. And when we think back to that story of Noah, it tells us that The hearts of the people of that day were only evil continually. They were contributing to the condition of their world. In Ezekiel, the scorpions weren't the people out there. The scorpions were the people in here. It was Israel that was acting like some kind of stinging bug. It was Israel that was being unfaithful to God. And when Ezekiel ate that scroll was a message about Israel's unfaithfulness, not being, the intent was that Israel would be God's representative in the world, showing the nations of the world what God is like. But instead, too often, they just participated in the things that the world did, in the ways that the world did it. And they contributed to the world's brokenness, and they contributed to the world's sinfulness, and they contributed to all of the difficulties that we find as a part of our world. And so if John is seeing a vision and it brings to mind Noah and it brings to mind Ezekiel, I think there are two things that I want us to get out of this. And one is that God is not unaware of the condition of our world. And he's not just letting it go its own way without intervention. I grew up predominantly reading the book of Revelation with very negative connotations. It's like, gosh, there's seven trumpets of judgment. There's seven bowls of wrath. There are these plagues that are unleashed in the world. There are these antichrists or this beast and this false prophet that are a part of bringing horrific things into the world and imposing on the church and on God's people. And it just horror after horror with a little bright light at the end of the book that kind of is, well, God wins. But to be honest with you, I think that the message of Revelation is really no different than the messages of the stories that we get in the Old Testament. I don't think it's substantially different than the parables that Jesus told or the teachings of the Sermon on the Mount. I don't think it's substantially different than the writings of Paul or the other New Testament writers. I think that one of the things that it's telling us is that, yes, the world is broken. Yes, there are things that we participate in the world in that make it more broken than it is on its own, but that God is aware and that God will ultimately make it right. And I'll tell you what, if you and I had to live in this world in a way that we just had to determine that, well, this is just the best it's ever going to be, then what hope would there be? I mean, I might give up. And I say that as somebody whose life has really been blessed in so many ways. But listen, this touches all of us. I know that we could look back and say, well, you don't have any reason to whine or complain because look at your life. I mean, look at you. And I've had a very blessed and wonderful life. But I also think of like David, King David in the Old Testament. David was a king, was probably the greatest king that Israel ever had. But read some of the Psalms. How do they go? God, how long are you going to allow the enemy to pursue me? God, how long are you going to allow the wicked in the world to prosper and the righteous to be neglected and overlooked? I mean, David was blessed, but it was a mixed blessing, wasn't it? I mean, even after David had been king, he got run out of Jerusalem by his own son, who was going to take over for him. Our lives are a mix. We have some blessing, but it feels like that we participate in a lot of the cursing as well. But God sees it. And a message that we get in the scriptures over and over and over again is that not only does he see it, but he is at work to do something about it. He will fix it. And a part of that is, another way that I typically read the Bible growing up was that judgment was all just punishment. Judgment and punishment were like synonyms. But in the Bible, judgment, the word for judgment is also the word for justice. I mean, the exact same word. Judgment and justice are the same word. And justice isn't just about punishing wrongdoers. I mean, it is about that, but it's not just about that. It's also about seeing those who have been mistreated unjustly getting their due restored to them. It's like the parable that Jesus told about the persistent woman who she went and she felt like she was being mistreated. She wasn't getting her due. And so she went to the home of a judge and she knocked on his door and she said, "Give me justice." But it says that this judge, he didn't care about people, he didn't care about justice, and he sure didn't care about this woman and her problems. And so he just ignored her. But she kept knocking on that door, and she kept saying, "Give me my due, give me justice, do what's right by me." And Jesus said in that parable that because of her persistence, the judge gave her, which he had no obligation to do, but he gave her what was her due. And then Jesus turns and he says, "How much more will God give to those who love him?" And what Jesus is doing is he's giving us a contrast. He's not telling us that God is that unjust judge who we have to pester in order to get him to do the right thing by us. He's actually saying that God is so much unlike that just judge that even if you could twist his arm to finally get him to do the right thing, how much more is a God who loves you, who cares about you, who wants the best for you, how much more will he do what is right for you when you ask? And so, two messages that John would have probably drawn from the Old Testament are that, well, sometimes we're a part of the problem, and God will fix that. But the other part of that is that when we find ourselves to be part of the problem, the question to us is, what will I do to stop that? How do I live a life in such a way that I am no longer a part of the problem, but I'm a part of the reflection of God's work in the world around me? And now, don't take that to mean that I'm saying that, well, we're all to go out and live perfect lives in the world and we can never make a mistake, because if we do, then we've just failed at the task that God has given us. That's not what it's about. It's about living a life that desires faithfulness to God. And I remember when I was probably a freshman or sophomore at OBU, and I would drive back into town on the weekends because I was teaching at our church at Crestwood. And one Sunday night, we called it training union, I think. We were having that on Sunday evenings, and I was teaching through a series. I was going to teach through how to know the will of God. And boy, did the people show up for that. And it wasn't because of me. It was because we all want to know, how can I know what the will of God is for me? And sometimes we make faithfulness a mystery. We make it this thing that, well, I don't know what, does God want me to do this or does God want me to do that? And we especially apply this to important decisions that we make in life, like choosing a spouse. Well, is this who God has in store for me or is there somebody else out there? And then we judge the results based on how successful it was. So if I get in a relationship and I get married and it doesn't seem to be working well, then I conclude that this wasn't God's will after all. I just misheard it. If it does work well, then I say, well, that must have been God's will, so everything's A-okay. Well, we've just mystified the will of God when we do that. And it's really, God doesn't intend it to be that difficult. Also, he doesn't intend us to judge it on the basis of the results, because just look at character after character in the Bible who was faithful to God and still had things go wrong. Faithfulness does not guarantee that everything will all of a sudden go right for us. Faithfulness does mean that everything ultimately will go right for us. Maybe not in the moment, but ultimately. And so there's one thing that is we see throughout the book of Revelation, and that is that the challenge to us to overcome, to be faithful. In those seven letters to the seven churches at the very beginning of Revelation, at the end of each one, it says, to him who overcomes will be given. And there's some gift that's given. To him who overcomes. It's like an acknowledgement that we live in a world that's difficult and we do the best that we can. Just do the best that you can. So how do you know what that best is? Though, if we've mystified it, if we've made it some kind of mystery, I don't know, is this the right, after 28 years, is Vera the right one for me? I don't know. Well, listen, here's how I want you to look at what it means to be faithful to God. And I'm going to try to make it really simple. It's just do the best thing that you know right now in these circumstances. Just do the best that you know right now in these circumstances. Whatever the circumstances are. Whatever the issue is that you need to make a decision about. When I think about when I asked Vera to marry me, I probably did at the time think, well, is this the one that God has for me? But probably a better question, and it is one that I asked alongside that, but probably a better question was, is this a good woman that I can build a good life with and we can both be faithful to the Lord and committed to Him for our lives? And if the answer to that is yes, then how could that not be the will of God? How could that be the wrong thing to do? Now, after 28 years, there have been times that I'm sure she's wanted to put a pillow over my face while we were in bed. There have been times that it's been difficult. That doesn't mean that it's no longer the will of God. It just means that in the midst of difficulty, you ask yourself, what's the best thing that I know to do right now? And sometimes it's just shut your mouth. So as we go and live in this world that's broken, as we live in this world that it just seems to be turned against the ways of God, the challenge to us is be overcomers, be conquerors, be the ones who are just faithful in your world at this moment. And every time you have a decision to make, something comes up, ask yourself, what's the best thing I know to do in the moment right now? What would honor God? What would be good? You don't have to ask yourself, is this the thing that God wants me to do? Just ask, is this something that God would look on and say, that was good? You did a good job. Then do that thing. And when the next moment comes up, do that thing. Do the best thing you know in that moment as well. And keep doing that, knowing that God is at work in the world to ultimately end the rule of sin and death in our world, to bring it all to judgment and to completion, and to reward those who walk faithfully with Him. Just do the best you can in the moment. And it's okay to ask God, God, help me, because we can't do it all on our own energy. We weren't intended to do it all on our own energy. He really rather likes it when we ask him, hey, can you come help me with this? And he'll jump in and he'll help. So there's a bit of a warning that both the Noah's Ark story and Israel's unfaithfulness in Ezekiel's day, that when we're unfaithful, well, that can put us on the wrong side of the things that take place when God starts to fix it. And God's not doing it necessarily to punish you so much as to correct you, to take you and I from being a part of the problem of unfaithfulness in our world and making us into people who are part of the faithfulness within the world, a reflection of his presence in this world. I said in Sunday school class this morning, because we were in chapter 17, that the church ought to be a place where the world can look and say, that's more like what this world should look like. More like what God intends the world to look like. And it doesn't mean that we eliminate, I mentioned that I've always thought about going into Sunday school class and just tear into somebody. I mean, let them have it. Like we're going to have a fight right here. Just to see how we react to that. Because this is kind of a training ground for our lives out in the world. If you and I can figure out together how to have an argument and love each other at the end of it, then we've just learned how to live like Jesus taught us to live. And if we can do that in here amongst one another, who are brothers and sisters in Christ, then maybe we can learn to do that out there when it's some cantankerous lawyer on the other end of the phone. Or it's somebody who's being rude in the line at Walmart. Or some other, because you're going to face those situations. And the question is, how will we face them? Well, we learn kind of in here how to do that so that we can go into the world and do that. And show the world that there's a better way. And in the end, even when we think about the flood story, or we think about Ezekiel, that God's intent was to never just say, I'm done with you. Because at the end of the flood story, there was a rainbow. And in this story, in Revelation 10, we see the rainbow reappear. And when God spoke to Israel in the midst of their unfaithfulness, very often they asked, well, how bad is it? And how bad is the judgment going to be? But as we keep reading those prophets, they always got to the point to where God said, listen, I'm not done with you. I'm not happy with your unfaithfulness, for sure, but I'm not done with you. I will never utterly destroy my people. He may correct us to try to get us on the right path, but he will not destroy us because that's not his intent. Instead, his intent is a world that reflects his glory all around, and we have a chance to build some of that here together as his church. Let's just be faithful. As faithful as we know how to be. And then we'll trust God with the rest.